Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, November 12th, Joe was joined by Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pondicio, Associate Professor of Government at Dutchess Community College, and President of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley, Dr. Karen Rydell, and Investment Banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman.
No matter what happens today and in the House of Representatives in regards to the shutdown, and we assume the reopening of government, as a fifth day of flight disruptions played out yesterday, airlines cautioned that it will take time for travel schedules to snap back, even if the agreement to reopen the federal government does go the distance. A Senate bill to end the shutdown is expected to be taken up by the House on Wednesday. But should lawmakers fail to move quickly, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy warned Tuesday there will be serious consequences for air travel. If the House doesn't pass this bill, you're going to look at Saturday, Sunday, and Monday as tiddlywinks. I don't know exactly what that means from Sean Duffy, but I like saying tiddlywinks. It's referring to a three-day span that saw nearly 7,000 flight cancellations and more than 28,000 delays. It's going to get much worse than that. Last week, the FAA ordered airlines to reduce their schedules at 40 major U.S. airports, beginning with a 4% rollback Friday. The head of the agency, Brian Bedford, said the reductions were necessary to reduce the strain on the aviation system as controllers and other frontline federal workers continue to work without pay during the shutdown, now the longest in history. This again from the Washington Post. Robert.
See my phone here, Joe?
Yes.
You know what that is? That is the directions on my iPhone for how long it will take me to drive from here to New Orleans, Louisiana, and it's 20 hours and 59 minutes. So I'm scheduled to fly to New Orleans and then Houston next week. So I'm watching this like a hawk because I would prefer not to have to get in my car for 24 hours on Monday. Yeah, look, what else is there to say? This is another one of those things. Okay, it's not like SNAP benefits that affect, you know, one out of eight Americans. But this one affects Americans who vote, right, who have the ear of politicians and who are nervous about travel plans coming up for Thanksgiving, which is, what, the busiest travel day of the year. So I don't think it's a coincidence that this has become a prime talking point for ending the shutdown, because this is one of those things that is profoundly disruptive to folks.
Mark.
Joe, I said it earlier. I fear that we've responded more to TSA and check-in lines than we did to lines at food banks. I don't really know what that says about us. It's not probably a good thing.
Karen.
Yes, I agree with both Mark and Robert on the assessment. And it's when you slow something down or you stop a service, then it takes a while to reinstate it. And I personally would err on the side of worrying. I do worry about air travel, not only because I want people to get around, and I know how miserable it is to be stuck at the airport and having one flight after the other canceled, but also because of the impact it has on especially smaller businesses right now. But I am more concerned about reinstating SNAP and how long it takes for the 3 million New Yorkers, for example, who depend on SNAP each month when they're going to get the support.
And that's a great point, too, because as sort of the right hand's doing its thing, the left hand's doing its thing, yesterday it came to the Supreme Court extending the order allowing limits on food stamp payments. So you have this ruling that's going on while the government's trying to get its act back together. But as of now, the justices have allowed the Trump administration to withhold full benefits for two more days while Congress worked to advance a government funding bill.
You're bearing the lead. That order was signed by who? Ketanji Brown Jackson.
No, actually not.
No.
Well, that initial order was the Supreme Court extended it on Tuesday, and actually Ketanji Brown Jackson was the dissent. On Friday evening, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, one of the court's three liberals, had temporarily granted an emergency request by the Trump administration to block a lower court judge's order that the government fund the anti-hunger program during the shutdown. Justice Jackson, who has written critically of many Trump administration policies, handled the emergency request because she is assigned to applications from the region of the country where the case originated. After Justice Jackson granted the temporary pause, she set a speedy briefing schedule in the food stamp case, but the Trump administration and the challenges had laid out their cases to justices by early Tuesday. But she did write the dissent in this particular case that came out yesterday, to my understanding. All right. Anyone else on that? Karen?
The emergency requests that are coming to the Supreme Court and that are granted by the Supreme Court from this administration are extraordinary. It's, I just looked up, I know that the Trump administration relies on them heavily. And I just looked up the data. It's Donald Trump used these emergency requests more frequent in the first 20 weeks of his second term compared to Biden's administration for 4 years. These emergency requests are problematic, of course, because the justices do not hear the cases. They don't hear arguments on both sides. They seem to be very keen on just granting them because they're short term. They don't have to tell us about the vote who voted for it. They don't have to give us an explanation, a justification. So whenever I hear about emergency requests, I'm deeply troubled again by the system that we have in place.
So maybe after the construction crews are done with the ballroom, they can install a drive-in window at the Supreme Court.
Diane says airline shutdown, more a middle class issue. No staff SNAP recipient is traveling for the holidays. Then we go to Patrick. You guys are pitiful. The shutdown drew the nation's attention to more than ACA health care. It gave the Democrats in the Senate the platform to also discuss affordability, SNAP cuts, health care costs in general, and Republican mean-spiritedness as they cut $4 trillion in taxes for the super wealthy and mega corporations as they meanwhile cut $2 trillion for health benefits from the working class, poor and retired people. The result of the Senate discussions leading up to the November vote were victories in Virginia, New Jersey, and California. The struggle will continue in January after we let the people have a Thanksgiving and a Christmas holiday, thus avoiding the Democrats playing the Grinch at year-end, another victory.
I would say that letter writer is not gainsaying my point, but amplifying it.
Well, I would pump the brakes on the effect on the election. There may have been a few Virginia House of Delegates seats that were swayed by this, but I think the results we saw were largely what we were going to see, whether or not there was a shutdown, frankly.
Yes, I think you're right. Or I agree with
you. The margins, I think, were larger than a lot of us expected, but I don't disagree with you at all.
All right, let's go to Barbara. People who can afford to fly, people who cannot even afford food. I'm much more concerned about the latter. And also, the priority of airlines over feeding the poor is more of an example of whose voices are heard loudest at this time. Those voices who hold power are not the poor, and that is why the food shortages affecting the poor was what was not a public priority. It was a priority to those who are least represented, the poor. That from Anonymous. All right. Anybody else on that? If not, I will move to our final.
I just want to make one quick remark, which is, and I think we talked about this last time, Joe, a shocking number of Americans, 1 out of 8, get SNAP, Supplementary Nutritional Assistance, or so-called food stamps. So the idea that there's, without question, there's, flyers are a lot more affluent than SNAP recipients, but there's some overlap there.
All right. We have about 5 minutes left. Let's go to Venezuela orders massive mobilization as U.S. aircraft carrier approaches. This from the Washington Post. The USS Gerald R. Ford aircraft carrier has entered waters near Latin America, prompting Venezuela to put the entire country's military arsenal at the ready. As the U.S. naval buildup fuels speculation that the Trump administration intends to dramatically escalate its deadly counter-narcotics campaign there, the Ford and its three accompanying warships arrived in the region Tuesday, the Navy said in a news release. The ships were not yet in the Caribbean Sea, but had crossed into the U.S. Southern Command's jurisdiction, a vast area that includes part of the Atlantic Ocean and drug smuggling routes in the Pacific used by cartels based in Colombia and neighboring Ecuador. Pentagon spokesman Sean Parnell said in a statement, these forces will enhance and augment existing capabilities to disrupt narcotics trafficking and degrade and dismantle transnational criminal organizations. The development, though forecast weeks ago, appeared certain to deepen the sense of unease felt in some corners of Congress since President Trump began to ruminate about a potential regime change in Venezuela. Mark.
Oh, here we go again, right? I mean, if the administration thinks removing Maduro is going to automatically solve the problem, they need to think again. History shows that the guys with the guns step into the vacuum. Look at Afghanistan. Look at Libya. Now Rubio's behind calling the shots. This is his version of America first empire management. I guess he finally gets to be Secretary of State on this one. They've done it with a bad sleight of hand. They've basically tried to turn drug interdiction procedures into a war by calling it narco-terrorism, therefore avoiding all the legal restraints that should be placed on the administration if they really do want to use the military. The kicker here is that we've let Chevron already back into Venezuela. They're cracking oil while we get ready for a potential conflict. And look, Latin America's got the receipts about how this doesn't work well, whether it be Guatemala, Chile, Nicaragua, Panama. I mean, it's literally a century. And we've seen this movie before. You topple the strong man, and we hate the sequel even worse. Let's call it what it is. It's just sort of regime change theater. Big openers, bad endings, and America never gets a refund.
Karen.
I'm reiterating what Mark is saying. Is that I'm trying to understand what the actual objective is, because it certainly isn't a war on drugs. We get from Venezuela cocaine. Cocaine's not the problem in the United States. I genuinely doubt that democratization is the real objective here either. And yes, there is oil there, and yes, the Venezuela is aligned with our adversaries, Russia, China, Iran. But given, as Mark says, history has shown regime change doesn't work well for us. And Venezuela has numerous factors that will make it particularly hard to achieve a real change, right? Given the regime's deep roots in the military, security services, paramilitaries, it'll be a very difficult undertaking if that's what the administration wants to do. So I'm not really sure what the objectives are, and I have the feeling that to a certain degree, it is just once again showing our military muscle, and this is something that his administration, both Trump and Hexas in particular, are very keen on doing, to show our military might and rely on the military might to achieve objectives abroad, and it just hasn't worked out well for us. So we'll see what the actual I'd like to hear other people's perspectives on what the actual objectives here are. It certainly are not the ones that are given by the administration.
Yeah, I think those cautions are well put. Regime change is a challenging game to play right, if at all. But that said, I don't necessarily agree that this is capricious or reckless use of force. And come on, Maduro's not a good guy. There is a compelling national interest in stopping the flow of drugs and dismantling the cartel networks. I'm not blithe about that. They are fueling violence, addiction, instability here at home. But there's a right way to do it. You know, clear objectives, congressional authorization, a strategy that brings the American people along. So the risk here is that this looks like kind of like a cowboy use of the military as opposed to, you know, following proper procedures.
First of all, you can't bomb the demand side of this equation. That's addiction. So that doesn't work. The problem is fentanyl in terms of lethality in the United States, not cocaine. So we're not anywhere near that one. And if you want to do this right, you need to make sure that the guys with guns aren't the ones sitting ready to fill the void when you create a void. And we're far from that. There hasn't been any reasonable planning down there. This is just, I don't know what they're planning, but it looks really dangerous to me.
That was Mark Whitman on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, November 12th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, November 13th, Joe was joined by publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, former vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, and executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel.
Let's go to stories and find out what's happening in this world. And the big story, of course, is we had the shutdown. For a long, long time. It was the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. 43 days. And it did cause disruption and it did cause a lot of delays. But as of last night, the President of the United States signed a bill to reopen the U.S. government. Many federal workers are expected back to work today. So the longest government shutdown in history is over. And speaking from the White House late Wednesday, Trump blamed the shutdown and its harmful effects squarely on the Democratic Party and portrayed its end as a Republican victory. He also urged voters to remember the shutdown ahead of the 2026 midterm elections, as if there's not a possibility for another shutdown before the 2026 midterms. But I digress. An apparent attempt to use the moment as political leverage, despite recent polls suggesting that more Americans do blame the GOP than the Democrats for the shutdown. This is no way to run a country. I hope we will all agree that the government should never be shut down again, Trump said in a live broadcast. He pledged to pass legislation to end politicians' ability to filibuster and send the federal government will, quote, now resume normal operations. Your interpretation of what normal operations...
It's the good news and the bad news.
Right, whatever that is. Earlier in the day, the House voted to reopen federal agencies, the first time it had been in session in nearly 8 weeks. House Speaker Mike Johnson had kept the chamber out of session since September 19th in a bid to pressure the Senate to agree to a GOP funding extension, which Senate Democrats had repeatedly rejected. Lawmakers voted 222 to 209 to reopen the government yesterday. The plan approved Wednesday was brokered over the weekend between Senate Republicans, 7 Senate Democrats, and 1 independent. It passed the upper chamber Monday night. We feel very relieved. The Democrat shutdown is finally over, Johnson told reporters after the House vote earlier Wednesday. All this was utterly pointless and foolish. This outcome was totally foreseeable. They got nothing for their selfish political stunt. That reporting from The Washington Post. Nick Rangel, what do you make of this?
Well, I guess, firstly, I think Mike Johnson is incorrect in his his assessment that the Democrats got nothing for the shutdown. When the shutdown first started, the Republicans were very skillful at placing the blame on the Democrats, and the vast majority of Americans blamed the Democrats. And as the shutdown continued, it became more and more clear that the majorities in both houses were not negotiating, not open to conversations, were out on recess, and were more than willing to allow people to go hungry instead of meeting Democrats at the table. And while it is true Democrats didn't get very much in the end in the bill itself, they did get some. They got SNAP funding for the whole year. They got people's jobs reinstated. They got back pay guaranteed for those federal employees, which were things that were not guaranteed without those concessions. And while they won't win the vote on healthcare vouchers, it is much more clear to most voters that their healthcare costs are going up because of choices that the Republicans are making, which was not clear at the beginning of the shutdown. So I think all of those things are political wins for the Democrats. How they leverage it is another question, but I do think that they got more than the speaker is pronouncing.
Judy Patrick.
You know, I hate the fact that the media frames this as who won, who lost, who's to blame, who's not to blame, but that's how the politicians are framing it and couching it. That being said, I think the Democrats, I agree with Nick, I think the Democrats came out ahead in large part because the ACA, the health insurance funding issue, is not resolved, and people are going to have to start paying more, or they're going to have no insurance at all, and that will reverberate all through next year during the midterm campaigns, and so that will benefit the Democrats. It's very clear. Also, can I just say that Mike Johnson spent the last 6 weeks telling us that he wanted people to vote on a clean CR with nothing else in it. But guess what was in this CR that they passed? It was this provision that allows the senators to sue for up to $500,000 because they're upset that Jack Smith may have subpoenaed their phone records. I mean, it wasn't just... CR, they put some other stuff on it, contrary to what Mike Johnson said he was going to do. So
he claims to have been unaware of that until he saw it. He didn't know they were going to do that.
Unaware until you read it.
You know, I was aware of it. Yeah. Read the news.
Yes, if only there was not an outlet to find out this information. Ira.
Well, I don't know. There's so many ways to go on this. And as you alluded, in January, the end of January, we may be right back where we are now. But I sort of was interested, and it piggybacks on what the others have said about the messaging here. The Republicans are very good at messaging and very good at drilling the same lines over and over to the point where you've hypnotized the public. And so every other sentence was, it's a Schumer shutdown. It's Democrats' fault. But those words to the contrary, generally speaking, the Democrats are getting more favorable reaction than not. I mean, I know a number of Democrats were upset about how they think that Schumer gave in. But I think that the point that the Democrats needed to make was made, and the health care issue is a significant one, and it shouldn't be brushed off, as the Republicans seem to have done. The other thing that interested me is that you may have read the story in the Washington Post a day or two ago about what Trump was doing during this whole time. Unlike past presidents who correctly saw the need to get themselves involved to try to come to an agreement, Trump was out golfing. He was traveling the world. He was destructing the White House, the East Wing. So I don't think yesterday was a good day for him. Although at the end of the day, he'll continue to say it was the Democrats' fault.
We have a letter from a listener who said, I saw Mike Johnson's remarks. Every word out of his mouth was a lie. Well, I don't know. I mean, it was they're certainly pushing the point that it was not the Republicans. The president did the same thing when he was signing the bill last night. And I don't want to pile on because whenever we say anything like this, we just get a lot of mean letters, and those are just from Teresa. But
our Teresa,
yeah, our Teresa. But you know, to blame, but to say that you know, certainly Democrats are doing the same thing of casting the blame, and I don't saying that it's the fault of Republicans, and I think Judy pointed this out. It's just this back and forth of whose fault it was instead of trying to come to some understanding of how we avoid it and maybe avoid it to the point where we don't have to go through this again at the end of January.
Well, you know, the Congress can negotiate the budget bills earlier before it is past due. That is a surprising trick of the trade. You could just start negotiating before it expires. We've been on a continuing resolution for over a year now because this whole year was a continuing resolution and last year was a continuing resolution. So Congress hasn't passed and adopted a new federal budget in 2 years. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah. And so in this instance, over the summer, the House went on a pretty long recess. They weren't there to do the work of negotiating a budget. They were unable to get a budget between the majority conferences in the House and in the Senate. Their budgets are billions of dollars apart, like their proposals. Those two majority conferences have still been unable to get two-way agreement on a spending proposal. I doubt they'll be able to do so in a month, and we're going to be in this situation again because the House has not been in Washington to do the work of negotiating a budget with their majority counterparts in the Senate.
Hey, and also they're going to take off at the end of the day. They'll be back next week for a few days, and then they've got a Thanksgiving recess. This from a group that's been off since September. I mean, I have often said I don't think the people in Congress work very hard. They'll say, "Oh, I mean, Mike Johnson was saying all our members are back home doing constituent services." You know what I'd love to see? I'd love to see a daily diary of what every congressperson does. We should make that public so their constituents can see how hard they're working or not.
Well, they're very defensive about that. I mean, I can recall not just congressmen, but with state legislators, when you'd say that you're rarely in session, aren't you guys working? And they would say, oh, we're doing constituent services, and we're doing this, and we're doing that. And I suspect that it's true to a certain point. But they ought to be mindful of the importance of me showing up in Washington and do the government's business. You were going to say.
Yeah, I would just say they didn't cancel their legislative days in the House. There were legislative days. They counted those legislative days towards their legislative calendar, but they didn't have any bills on any of those legislative days. They haven't passed a bill since September 19th, I think. It is conceivable that on a non-session day, the lawmakers are still working towards negotiating a bill. They're still getting presentations by their staff or updates from staff. They're giving directions to staff on what to do next. That doesn't happen when they're actually in their district. And I think the distinction is important. You can have non-legislative days or days that you're not in session, but you are in D.C. and you are working on these bills. But when you send people back to Alaska, it is far less likely that you are both getting updates on negotiations and also providing feedback on what those budget bills are going to look like. And I think that technical work, it has to be in the Capitol.
Well, and even aside from the showdown and the issues that arise, I think a fair complaint is in the last couple of decades, and I'm not sure where the line of demarcation is, the congressmen and senators are in town for several days, and then they immediately go home, and then that means that they're not interacting with themselves. They're not having dinner, or they're not...
that you know of. Well, we have a couple letters here. We welcome yours. As a spouse of a staffer to a Democratic U.S. senator of whom I have a critique, writes Matt. I can assure you negotiations happen no matter where the member is. If the member is of a mind to negotiate, furthermore, much negotiation happens between senior staffers across committees and member offices. So I believe the point being made by Matt is you don't have to be in Washington, D.C., at the, say, the Rayburn Building to make stuff happen.
Yeah, but, I'm obviously not one of them, but people who have experienced this in a different time will remind you that when they did get together, when they 5 o'clock came and they went and had a couple of cocktails, and the senators and Congress people got to know each other, the tone of the Congress was better, the production of the Congress was better, and the ratcheting down of tensions in the country was better.
And the COVID work from home argument continues, right?
I was just going to make one other point. If the Senate and the President and the Congress want to score some points, and I presume that they can do this, they must put an amendment or rewrite the law so that federal workers who are actually out there working are being paid while they're working. I don't believe that the rank and file of this nation would dispute the fact that the TSA agents and the air traffic controllers, to name two, if they were going to come in, they shouldn't have been asked to come in for no pay, even though they were going to get back pay, because a lot of them are going hand to mouth. I don't know why that rule exists, but it's a bad rule and it ought to be changed.
And at least it was negotiated within this agreement that was voted on last night.
Well, it was negotiated that they'll get paid for what they've done, but come January 30th, if there's another shutdown, we're back to where we are.
6-7, Ira.
6-7.
6-7.
I just want to respond. I spent many years on central staff in the state Senate negotiating bills in counsel's office, and I am not disputing that negotiations can't happen remotely. What I am doubling down on is what Ira mentioned, is that moving large budget bills is exponentially quicker and more efficient when people are all there. You have conference together. You talk about confidential debates in closed session, in closed conference. You deal with those really sticky conversations in person. It was evident that any negotiations were crawling at a snail's pace while the House was sent on recess. And there are reports of that all over the press.
Right. And I mean, not to be Captain Obvious here, but that's everything is shut down, right? I mean, that's sort of the point of it, in the sense of it is what it is billed to be. Let's go to I didn't finish Matt's letter, and I apologize. There, Matt was making the point that you could negotiate from anywhere, but saying there is plenty to critique about U.S. Congress, but the broad brush is about what work is being done and when are often quite incorrect. That said, plenty was not happening because some were clearly not of a mind to let it happen these past many weeks. That from Matt. Then we go to Craig. With the first comment, the vast majority of Americans did not blame Democrats for the shutdown. On the contrary, from The Hill, the publication, November 2nd, most voters in a new survey blame either President Trump or Republicans in Congress for the federal shutdown, which has now stretched into its second month. In an NBC poll conducted in late October, 52% of voters say Trump and or the Republican Party is responsible for the federal shutdown, including 25% who blame congressional Republicans, 24% who blame Trump, and 3% who say they blame both, even after they were asked to select between the two. I think you can find whatever numbers you want to find in polls that are out there. I will say, Craig, that as you note in your letter about this from The Hill on November 2nd, a lot of this came from the exit polling that was taken at the time of the election on Election Day. And the polls that were generated from that seem to show that the Democrats, and again, they were also, the Democrats did well. So it would make sense to say that was going to be the result of the poll. But I think when that is used, it's not that it's incorrect. It's just that that's where that information comes from.
Right. That timeline
correct.
Is independent of the shutdown. Although I think if the Democrats had voted to end the shutdown before that election, they would not have done as well.
And one of my points is that if the media spends so much time figuring out who's to blame or who America blames, they spend less time talking about the real issues involved or what's actually happening or what's happening behind the scenes. I mean, the repercussions of this or why aren't they adopting a budget at a regular time frame like cities and towns and counties are doing right now, you know, getting a budget in place before the start of the fiscal year. I'm just saying too much media focus is on winners and losers and not enough on the real consequences.
Well,
many in the media do.
Yeah, some in the media was what the second sentence I was going to say. Yeah. But the first sentence was, I think that the media writ large is doing better on this point. Yes, you have stories about polling, and it's part of the story, but I don't see them ignoring the crux issues. So I think it's possible to have your cake and eat it. I think it's difficult as the media finds itself with fewer people and is more split than it used to be. But I think when this issue about horse races and polling came up years ago. Since then, you can see there has been less of an emphasis.
That was Ira Fussfeld on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, November 13th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review. On Friday, November 14th, Joe was joined by Joseph Palamountain Jr., Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin, Ulster County Comptroller and former President and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, Executive Director of Communities for Local Power and former White House Advance Lead, Anna Markowitz, and semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer for The Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz.
A lot of things sort of merge together and or kind of smoosh together.
Epstein.
Well, right. And then this the MAGA leaders upset over that the assertion that the U.S. needs foreign workers, and that rift has gotten them upset, as has the Epstein files, and that as well. Meanwhile, the plan on what's going to happen with the congressional push on the Epstein files is something to watch as well. I would like the Epstein story, of course, is in this, but I would like to just focus on the America First part at the beginning, and then we'll get into Epstein. But MAGA leaders erupted this week over President Donald Trump's assertion that the United States needs foreign workers because it does not have enough talented people, questioning the president's commitment to America First politics that he has popularized. A congressional push to release the government's files on sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, a years-long cause on the right, move forward against the wishes of the White House, even as Republicans overwhelmingly dismissed newly released emails Epstein wrote, including some about Trump. And Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, Republican, a longtime Trump ally, sparred with the president on multiple fronts after suggesting that the White House was too focused on foreign affairs and denouncing recent aid to Argentina. I'm telling you, if you see Marjorie Taylor Greene on these interviews that she's doing on CNN and MSNBC, on MSNBC, I don't know what happened to my human brain. It's so discordant. I don't get it.
Is she the same person?
No.
Is it possible that she's been replaced?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if I'm the same person, quite frankly. The dissent showed an impassioned base willing to challenge Trump on some issues while largely supporting his leadership overall. Trump's critics voice skepticism that the risk will hurt the president's support in hurt the president's support in any lasting way. But the rare criticism showed the limits of Trump's authority over the America First agenda that he championed as a candidate and raised some GOP concerns about enthusiasm ahead of the 2026 midterm elections. The president, and I think many of you have seen memes or have seen clips or have seen comedic interpretation of the president with his fun new word, affordability. He's talking as if he had never heard that word before. And now he said there's a new word out and it's called affordability. And so the last few days has been focused on that. Bo.
So, Joe, is it possible that Marjorie Taylor Greene is an GOP evil genius? And the reason why I asked this question.
Yes, that is possible.
The reason why I asked this question is because I'm going to take a slightly different lens at this. At the criticism that Trump is getting from whether it's on the immigration front or on the Epstein files front. He's been criticized in the past before, and eventually or quickly the MAGA folks have forgiven him. This one might have a little bit more of a staying power, but what's interesting to me is the fact that at some point soon, the GOP has to decide how to move on from Trump as the demagogue, the autocrat, and the populist sort of band leader. And it's possible that Marjorie Taylor Greene is sort of accelerating that move on. And what I mean by that is if you look at historically the populists in this country, and from Andrew Jackson to George Wallace, they were all firebrands that could generate enthusiasm from their particular group. But once they lost their place on the political landscape, their political parties and their political movements died down. Is Marjorie Taylor Greene sort of accelerating this post-Trump, keep MAGA going mentality? At some point, Trump is going to drop off the political spectrum. And who's going to take that place in this sort of moment in which we're talking about a populist MAGA world? Is it going to be Nick Fuentes? I don't think so. Is it going to be somebody else? But the GOP has to decide who's going to replace Trump. And I think that we're starting to see that movement happening. So I don't know if this is a conscious decision on the part of critics like Laura Ingraham or Marjorie Taylor Greene. But I do think it's we should pay attention. Democrats in particular should pay attention to the reality that Trump will not be on the landscape forever. And there's going to be a continued populist movement beyond it. I think the last thing I'll say here is I think the Democrats have a steeper hill to climb if that accelerated post-Trump era comes more quickly than if it comes in 2028.
Anna.
I mean, I would love for us to be moving on from Trump right now. We unfortunately have three more years, and I don't think he's quite ready to give up the baton of being the leader. I think that this will fade just like everything seems to fade. I think that he's giving these visas for people who are college educated, who are giving $100,000 to the government for these visas. And meanwhile, is pulling people off the streets with ICE. And I think if we're looking at what the MAGA movement cares more about, they care more about ICE and that type of immigration than they do about this kind of higher echelon of immigrants. I would love to be wrong about that. I personally would love all immigrants to be here, but that's the lens I think they're looking at it through.
I thought that Laura Ingraham looked surprised. I think when she asked Trump, you know, well, don't we have talent here? She expected him to say, yes, we do, and we need some additional. But he said, no, you don't have talent here. And that just, she looked kind of really surprised by that, which made me want to go and see what other conservative commentators are saying. I went on Twitter X to see what people were saying, and I was kind of shocked. I mean, Nick Fuentes said, you know, this is not America first. Trump has not delivered. We were better off with Biden. I kind of was jaw-dropping watching that. I'm not kidding you. Bannon says, you know, this is for the tech bros and oligarchs. That's what this visa mm-hmm. program is for. Tim Pool said, don't worry, quote-unquote, don't worry, Trump is bringing plenty of H-1Bs to make sure our young people are, fill in the blank, I can't say it on radio. And so that was surprising to me. I also saw a lot of criticism for the Trump organization itself having so many people on H-2A and H-2B visas working at Mar-a-Lago, hundreds of people. So I don't know if it'll fade. I hope that it doesn't. I feel like people are digging in on this, wait, what about America first thing? And Trump saying he's the arbiter of what makes America great really upset people, I think.
Quick sideline, but my favorite Steve Bannon quote of the week was him saying, you know what? If this keeps up, I'm going to end up in jail.
Yep.
And I was like, oh, please don't do that. Yes, for God's sakes.
You know, we have written so many times in editorials that I've lost count of how many times we have argued that you need immigration in the United States for all sorts of reasons, whether it's, you know, raw labor, in agriculture, or whether it is talented people who we ought to be doing more to keep in this country and turn into citizens and enjoy the fruits of the American education system, higher education system in helping these people fulfill their dreams. And when I read that part that he said to Laura Ingraham, I got defensive about it. That it was just like, wait a second, America doesn't have talented people, is what you're saying, and you know, this is extraordinary to hear from Trump. But I was kind of offended.
Well, I took the same as Marge was describing that you like did I miss? Is this just a clip taken out of context? Did I miss the context? Did I miss the prelude? Did I miss?
Yeah. This is
the footnote. What it was odd.
This is the aha moment for a lot of people in MAGA land who now understand what we all have understood, which is that Trump, for all his life, has been a lot of things. He's, but most of all, he's a chameleon. In a lot of ways, and I think what's happened is the chameleon kind of has lost his ability to change, and now he's in the position of having to defend where he is. And what he is, and what his policies are, and everything else. And now he's in this position where he's going to start saying things like this, I think, more and more.
Republican strategist Steve Cortez, who has argued that the U.S. admits too many foreign workers and foreign students, says, if you don't show them that you're not standing up for them on these populist nationalist issues, I think there's a real risk for the 2026 midterms. I don't know anyone on the right who's so angry that they're splitting with Donald Trump, but we're disappointed, and we want to lead him to a better place. Anyone have an idea of how you do that?
You know,
gold stickies from Home Depot might do it.
Before this election, before this presidency, I would have said you lead him along by showing him where his strength lies, where populism lies, and what the right things to say are. Because the one thing that is apparent about him now, and a lot of MAGA people are, coming to terms with it, or realizing it anyway, and maybe not coming to terms with it, is that he is the consummate politician, who the person you say, you describe as, they will say and do anything it takes to get elected. So he would have, before this election, you could have easily led Trump. Now he is in this place where I think even he knows it's his last term. He stands to be potentially a lame duck after the next congressional election, and you're not going to lead him anywhere. But to say that is to miss I think the dynamics of where we are now, which is exactly what I said, that he is at the end of his political life, and he's not going to be led anywhere. Now he's just going to give us Trump, and there'll be people, you know, who ultimately shrug their shoulders. I think when you say, you know, this is going to pass, who ultimately shrug their shoulders and say, well, it's Trump being Trump again. He's telling it like it is. I guess we have to accept that.
Well, I have this thing like it's a, you know, it's a really old, and this isn't a, I'm not slighting Trump's age, but it's just like it's the aging 70s or 80s band where you're like, yeah, I know they're not as good as they used to be, but let's let's just go and listen to the hits. Like, right?
Who are you talking about, Bon Jovi or Supertramp?
Ooh, sounds like fighting words.
Yes. No, but it just seems to me that the people like they like hearing that stuff, like mm-hmm. go hear his greatest hits,
right.
And even if it's not based in real reality, then that doesn't.
But if they
seem
start
to
feel that he's insincere, then we're at in a very short span of time, we're at the Reagan betrayal.
Yeah,
you know that Ronald Reagan ultimately, for all, and he was still being remembered fondly as the greatest conservative ever, in well into the 90s. But there were other people in the right, on the far right, you know, screaming on right wing radio about how they were betrayed, particularly on immigration, by Reagan's promises, and then he, you know, just you know basically gave you know it was basically an amnesty for everybody in exchange for a promise that the borders were going to be sealed tight, and they weren't. So never trust Republicans again, and then here Trump comes along and everybody says, oh, we'll trust him.
And we are starting to see those right-wing voices, like I was just saying, that I had seen on Twitter and in the videos where people are questioning him. And I think it does open the door and give license to people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and others, Massey from Kentucky, to start, you know, really rattling the cages and disagreeing. Disagreeing with Trump has to become okay for Republicans. That's the place we need to go to, right? Yeah. They have to be able to question him and to push back.
But he's had I totally agree with Jay and March, the both of you. He's had a pretty phenomenal run in the second term,
yeah.
Right? So the question for me is his confidence even remotely shaken by this moment? My guess is the answer is no. Right. Epstein, I think, is a slightly bigger issue for him. But I don't think the interview with Laura Ingraham is going to shake his confidence, because I actually think he's just sort of shooting from the hip in that moment. Right. He's we're applying a standard of rationality on Trump that he has never shown to be rational in these moments. He's shown to be autocratic and all-powerful. And so I think it's a mistake for us to think that there was some rational moment in there. And that said, he still is the, you know, flag bearer for the GOP. And as long as he's a flag bearer for the GOP, I think he's going to maintain the same level of confidence.
He's always benefited from other people, having other people around him, either paid to clean up
right.
that you know, that misstatement, or willing to do it, like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Elise Stefanik and the Speaker of the House. I don't know why his name.
Mike Johnson?
I keep losing his name all week. You know, when those people aren't cleaning up for him, that's a bad sign for him. That's when he may have his uh-oh moment, maybe. Or he'll get
maybe.
It, or he'll lash out.
I think the next uh-oh moment for him is when Democrats win 35 additional seats at the midterm, and I think it's probably going to be around between 30 and 40. I think that's the uh-oh moment for him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he thinks he's untouchable, like you said, and I think he also thinks he has the ability to spin this. You know, there's no president that really has been more pro-America, you know, not America, because, you know, but pro MAGA, you know, than him. And I think that he will point to the changes that he has made in immigration, you know, in the like lower income immigrants that he has managed to remove, and say, hey, find another president that's willing to take a greater stand on this issue that you care deeply about. And if this is your priority, if this is what you're voting on, nobody's going to do more than me. You just have to let me get away with some small things that you might not agree on.
I was surprised that there wasn't conversation about how if you really feel that we don't have the talent here, you know, cutting the Department of Education and clawing back millions of dollars of research money from universities might not be the way to go. And I just haven't seen that conversation happening. And I was kind of surprised. I thought there would be people writing about that, but that didn't seem to
be. We
want to
get more $100,000 visa applications. Yeah. And so let's just cut all of the education so we have to import everybody.
All right, couple letters, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll come back for more letters. Let's see. We begin with Vincent. Trump's understanding of what has truly made America great is practically non-existent, i.e. science and research, world-class higher education, a nonpartisan professional military, immigrants bringing myriad skills. It's no surprise that his recent talent comment is equally ignorant. That from Vincent. We go to Suzanne. I think Bo is exactly right. The writing is on the wall that Trump is not long for this world, and everyone wants to be the one who inherits his base, while Vance has the best position right now. It's very clear that no one likes him, and he lacks the charisma to keep MAGA together. The disagreement between the administration and the base over the Epstein files is the most obvious lever to shift the balance of power as soon as Trump is out of the picture. MTG sees that. Others, like rats from a sinking ship, will follow other political flotsam or commit themselves to her raft until they see an opportunity to shove her off. Interesting times. Well, you certainly painted a picture, Suzanne. That's good. Then we check in with John. When Trump says that he's never heard of affordability, I believe him. It's in a group with compassion and constitutionality and logic, you know, words that he just does not seem to be all that familiar with. Thank you, John. Then we go to Frank. I believe that Marjorie Taylor Greene is, quote, moderating her public persona because she's positioning herself to run for the Senate. That from Frank. Then we go to this letter from also about Marjorie Taylor Greene. I'm curious to hear how you see Marjorie Taylor Greene has changed. Perhaps she is breaking away from Trump. Well, that's what we've been talking about. And I think, you know, as it suits, right?
Yeah. And the question, that kind of runs through that entire discussion is, is the MAGA universe going to perceive her as opportunistic, or are they going to see her as sincere? Is she truly a populist who is now sounding rational, or is she just a populist who's trying to sound rational so she can get ahead, and she's betraying them along the way?
Yeah. And the other thing is that I find so fascinating is the fact that if you are on the tail end, the margins of the party, as Marjorie Taylor Greene has historically been, right? Maybe she's moving a little bit towards the middle. If you're on the tail end of that, AOC on the other side, you get a disproportionate amount of press coverage, right?
Yes.
There is no Marjorie Taylor Greene is one of 435 members of Congress. And so why aren't we paying attention to those in the middle who are the more rational figures? And in fact, if American politics has become a tail marginal extreme right and left politics, we're in more trouble than just one autocratic president.
That was Bo Breslin on the Roundtable panel on Friday, November 14th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.